I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. What makes someone want to take on a job that sometimes has everyone applauding you and at other times has you hearing a chorus of boos? That's one of the questions we'll ask as we continue our series of debates with candidates for Kansas City Council. Today, meet Melissa Robinson and Joey Thomas, two newcomers facing off for the 3rd District seat. We'll ask them what they hope to do if they win and how they plan to do it. Then, there are some U.S. citizens working and paying taxes in this country who are not allowed a say in their government. We'll hear the case for doing something that hasn't happened in this country since 1971, and that's lowering the voting age. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The race for the 3rd in-district seat on the Kansas City Council features two community activists well known in their East Side community. The election is June 18th. Voters will also pick other council members and a new mayor on that day. Now, another in our ongoing series of conversations with the candidates. The 3rd district contenders are Melissa Robinson. She's president of the Black Healthcare Coalition and a former board president for Kansas City Public Schools. Melissa, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Joey Thomas is also here. He's a licensed barber, a mentor, and entrepreneur who started his first business, Joey Cuts Barber Salon, at 39th in Indiana. Joey, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you as well.
I want to ask about the 18th and Vine Jazz District that's near and dear to my heart because of my love for the music. The city, Joey, has invested a lot of money in the American Jazz Museum, and the museum continues to struggle. I'm wondering, what's the path forward with the museum and the district? It's in the 3rd District, I should point out. Should the city continue to invest there? Should it back off? What do you think?
I mean, as a business owner down on 18th and Vine now for over 5 years, of course, my vote would definitely be to increase the support, funds, resources, the whole nine. However, there are a body of business owners down there that feel as if the resources aren't available. Mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to growth, when it comes to expansion, when it comes to just being able to tap into to help with daytime traffic, nighttime traffic, security, trash, right. Blight, the whole nine. There are a body of not only business owners, but also residential individuals as well that would love to see more involvement on behalf of the city.
You know, a lot of city residents, though, elsewhere think the city's already dumped too much money, good money after bad money here in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's case by case and opinions, you know. But again, being down there for over 5 years, I definitely see the potential of an area like 18th and Vine. I see the growth, but however, I wish that we would be able to just be able to grab a little more to make it possible for the business owners that aren't inside of properties that's owned by the city. Yeah. You know, having more resources for people like myself and others.
Melissa Robinson, what's the path forward for the 18th and Vine Jazz District and for the museum?
We need a public-private investment, and we have to have a partnership. And so we have a lot of public investment that's been done there. We need to attract development, a developer, so that we can match those dollars. We need to look at layering on the incentives that are available down there to attract developers. So, for example, it's in an area where there's an opportunity zone. We've given PIAC money. We can continue to invest there, but we're missing that privatization part of things.
Why have developers been so hesitant to come down? I mean, the district's been around now for a while. What's been the hesitancy?
It's a very unique space. I mean, it's very unique. It's different from Bill Street. It's different right. from other entertainment districts. You have to make sure that you preserve the cultural value and the historical significance there. We need strong entrepreneurship down there. I believe that we need to make sure that we have more income incubators for micro businesses to make sure that it is fully occupied, but mm-hmm. we need that private investment to come as well. And I think that it is the responsibility, and I know that work has been done previously, but we have to continue to beat that drum to ensure that we're getting a private developer to pay attention to the benefit and the potential that's there.
I mean, is there still a bright future for the Jazz District?
Absolutely.
Or has that changed? Do you both agree with that or not?
Absolutely.
Oh, no, there's a lot of people that want to be involved. I didn't mean to cut you off. A lot of people that still want to be involved. All the time I'm hearing people all the time ask, hey, is any spots open, any locations open? So there's a huge need and urgency for people to want to be down there, whether it be business, to live, to just enjoy themselves for the evening. But again, to Melissa's point, myself, I work closely with a group of us that's in the process now of creating a CID, privatization. Those type of things has been on the I guess you can say, chopping block, and we've been discussed. But with a CID, we all are in agreement to know that we need more of a big type of business that can really have a lot more retail. You know, mm-hmm. right now, trying to create a CID for a place like a barbershop, that really wouldn't be what it takes.
So you're wanting to see more retail down there, Joey? Am I hearing you right?
Just more business structure. I would love to see more big business, whether that be something like restaurants, food chains, franchises, things that can maybe generate just more traffic, more volume.
Melissa?
And one of the things that developers talk about when they think about 18th and Vine and development, Easter Truist, in general, and that is housing density. We're losing more and more people from the third district. That's why our footprint is so large, because we have to get to those density numbers.
Right.
And we have to have a strong housing plan,
right.
mixed income housing plan for the district as well. We have the Parade Park Homes that's just east of there. They have some critical issues going on, and that will be something at the top of my list, is reaching out to those that are in that co-op to see how that we can bring Parade Park back up so that it is that middle class place where people can live as it was when it was first established, right. and create the density.
I want to ask you both about some statements on your websites. Joey, you say point blank on your site that the people of the third district need to have the courage to stand up to the violence by reporting things when we know something. In other words, you want residents to cooperate with police when they can. Why has that proven to be such a tall order in the third district, and how would you change that?
I mean, it's really honestly because of relationships, narratives, and experience. You know,
right.
Myself, I'm a victim of, I guess you can say, violence. You know, father was killed at the age of two. Not only was father killed, my father was killed by a police officer. Mm. You know, a police officer that was awarded, you know, for killing my father, and was never proven that he per se did anything wrong. So from then till now, you know I've met a lot of people throughout my life that's had those same type of experiences, whether it been good experiences, bad experiences. But so
given your experience, why would you want to cooperate with police given what you've been through?
Because I know at some point in time that in order to move forward, you have to operate through a thing called forgiveness. You know, it's important. Right now in the area like the 3rd District, our people suffer from a lot of mental setbacks, emotional setbacks, the whole nine. When it comes to communicating, when it comes to talking about feelings, emotions, and all that kind of stuff, it's just something that's really not looked upon. It's nothing that's not really supported. So
how do you reestablish that trust that's apparently lacking in police community relations right now?
Talking to that person, being able to relate to that person that can have that shared experience,
right.
You know, creating those programs, creating those chances to have that discussion, that dialogue. I'm in the process now. I'm wanting to put together a big Father's Day event on Monday, the 17th. That was my goal. I was trying to work with several venues, and I'm having some unsuccessful luck. So if anybody's hearing that would love for us to have a venue that we can host maybe several hundred people or more. It's a movie that came out called Kingdom Men Rising. By Pastor Tony Evans. And I went to watch the movie with Pastor Edwards at United Believers Church. And for me, the movie was it touched my soul. It touched my soul, and it touched my soul in a way that it made me want to do something more when it comes to reaching out and connecting to just other males within my community. Because without a doubt, the males in our community, we need to have a voice. We need to have we need to be able to stand back in leadership. We need to be able to speak about things that we've been through to overcome some of these things. Because without the proper relationships, without the proper and effective communication, all these problems are going to increase.
Melissa, how would you get residents to open up to police when a crime occurs in one of your neighborhoods?
Well, you have to look at some of the root causes of what's happening with the dynamics with the police department. And Kansas City, we're over 300 square miles. And when we look at St. Louis, they're about a third of us, 63 square miles. We have less police officers than they have. So our police department is not able to do community policing in the way that it's prescribed
because
they're going from call to call. We don't have enough officers. I am proud of the business plan that the city currently has to increase officers that's currently in the plan. We need to continue that. But we need to have community-based solutions. We know that most of the homicides that occur and the aggravated assaults occur because of people's inability to handle conflict. And so how are we dealing with mental health? How are we utilizing our health levy dollars? How are we working with the community to come up with solutions to partner with the police and law enforcement to get things done?
It's not just some of that already happening. Aren't there community meetings going on with the police to sort of navigate exactly what you're talking about?
Yes, there is some of that, but we need community policing. And that means police officers, not just going to meetings, that's part of it, but that is just a small part of the equation. They need to know what's going on in the neighborhood, having those relationships with the people on the street, on the ground. And our officers, we cannot do that because we do not have enough officers.
And so the answer is hiring more police officers. I mean, again, we've talked on this show any number of times in recent weeks as we do these conversations with candidates. The city's already spending, you know, 3/4 of its budget on public safety. Do you want to increase that?
Again, looking at our square miles that we have, we are not able to do what we can do in terms of basic city services.
So you're saying yes.
Yes, we need to make sure that we are able to increase the number of officers so that we can have community policing. You cannot do it with the model that we have currently.
Joey, does that make sense to you, that approach to law enforcement?
I'm a little torn on that one. For me, I'm the type of person that I would love to say that I'm a problem solver, and I've had a lot of success.
You do that when you're a barber. You solve a lot of problems, right? That's what you do during the day.
And I would like to say that I've had a lot of success solving problems with just truly, genuinely having the support of the community. So, again, going back to what's needed, you know, what's going on in our community, in our communities, I think that at this point there needs to be not only a level of communication, a level of relationship, the policing. I would love to see more police involved in more things throughout the community, whether that be involvement in neighborhood associations, cleaning up the neighborhoods, people that's already putting on different type of events that are successful in regards to gathering people in the neighborhood.
Melissa Robinson saying you can't do that unless you get more police officers.
I don't think necessarily more police officers are needed, but I think that having the presence of police officers, letting the kids see, or letting our youth and our future and our, and really just leaders in our community and residents in our community see that the police actually care, I think that might change.
And they don't see that now, you're saying?
I think it's kind of hard to see that now. You know, when every day when you get up on Facebook or you watch TV, you see all these different movies and videos about another person being killed, murdered. I think without a doubt, psychologically, that puts that plants something in your mind to make you think that these people are bad.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking to the third in-district candidates for city council. The election is June 18th. Melissa Robinson, Joey Thomas. Melissa, go ahead.
Just last year, we were at a community event, and it would have been great to have police officers there playing with the kids. There was somebody that came with a gun around children. We called the police. It took them 3 hours to get there in the east side. And so what we needed from the police is to be able to get to make sure that people were safe. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we need to address the shortage of police that we have so that they can do, it's an ends to a means, so that they can do their job, so they can be involved and be present in developing those relationships.
Joey, you say you want to see the city deal with the systemic issues that are at the root of crime. This is from your website again. Mm-hmm. Poverty, mental illness, addiction, and homelessness. Hasn't the city already been doing that?
Has the city already been putting certain things in place? Yes. Has the city been putting the right people in place? I'm going to say no. And the reason why I'm going to say no is because, again, sometimes the message can be clear, but sometimes the messenger can just not be have a connection. And again, in a place like the 3rd District, in the area where I'm from, you know, one of the reasons why we opened up our shop on 39th Indiana is because not only did I grow up in that area, but I was seeing the problems in that area. Two incidents happened before I opened up my shop. One week I rolled up there to go sign some paperwork. As I'm sitting inside the salon, before it was even mine, about 5 minutes in there just looking around, a shootout took place right across the street at the Family Dollar. Okay. The next week I went up there to do some other paperwork. As I'm driving past college to go to Indiana, it was a body laid in the middle of the street, around the corner on the intersection of 39th Indiana. I'm sitting inside my shop and I'm thinking to myself and I'm asking myself, Lord, why? Why are you putting me here, showing me these things? And the only answer that was given to me, not in my mind, but in my heart, was I'm here for a purpose and I'm here for a reason. And the reason and the purpose was to not only inspire but transform the mindset within that community. Because, again, a lot of our people are broken because of the generational curses and mindsets that's placed on our community. So, therefore, you have to have people that's willing and that's committed and that's willing to make that sacrifice to change the mindsets, to have the relationships, to have the effectiveness, and go all the way. You know, I tell my friends and stuff all the time, if you're not willing to do this thing for legacy, if you're not willing to do this thing for life, right, you're in my way.
Let me scoot on to a different topic in the few minutes we have left here. Melissa, you say on your website that you're committed to ensuring that longtime residents are not forced to move ahead of a wave of gentrification, a big multisyllabic word that's got a lot of people concerned in the 3rd District. Tell our listeners why gentrification has become an issue in the 3rd and what you would do about it. How do you approach something like that?
Absolutely. One, again, we have to look at density and building mixed income housing. We can't have these enclaves of places where people that are out of affordability reach. And so we need to look at, we have a lot of vacant property that is in the 3rd District. We know that ownership of land helps to protect against gentrification. And so we need that. We know that
local ownership,
mm-hmm. Definitely. So increasing that, as well as looking at the mobility factor of making sure that there's fair housing for people who want to rent as mm-hmm. well. But we need to have those conversations about how people are being priced out of their homes based on the taxes, and how we can utilize sweat equity as a tax abatement. So if people are coming in purchasing these larger big homes or expensive homes, and then the person next to you, yes, their housing value goes up, but their taxes go up as well. And mm-hmm. so many times people on fixed incomes are stuck between, I have to move because I can't afford the taxes. And so there's a policy lane to that, to where we can look at giving tax abatements as well. And I know that there are some programs on the books that are doing that now, but you do have to put in more equity in your home. And I believe you being there is a part of the equity as well.
So you want to lower property taxes through some kind of program going forward in the 3rd.
For individuals who have been in their homes for 10 plus years.
Okay.
So that they're not forced out.
Joey, how would you approach gentrification in the 3rd?
Oh, man. So gentrification, yeah. That's an interesting word because...
yes, it is.
Yeah, gentrification. I like to say that gentrification is a ripple, and that opportunity zones is the monsoon that's creating the waves, that's creating the ripples. So gentrification, you know, in my opinion, I think that it comes with, I think the ways to attack it right now in the area like 3rd District is we need more education about it. We need more financial education. We need more access to capital. You know, we cannot act like redlining is not a real situation. We cannot act like that for the last 20 to 40 years that these plans weren't already in motion. Mm-hmm. We need more transparency, you know, because the reality...
How would you lower property if the concern is soaring property taxes? How would you deal with that?
I think that's something that would require a bigger case study than just me blurting the answer, because that's something that involves a lot of lives and involves generations, and I would hate to just give a uneducated answer, but without a doubt, it's something that will definitely be a huge focus and a priority of mine, is not only making sure that our communities are safe, but that our communities have the access to cap finances like everybody else. Make this an even playing field.
Again, we're visiting with the two candidates for the 3rd District in-district city council seat. The election is June 18th. Different issue. Joey, on your website, you say that no residential developer should be given tax incentives, I'm going to quote here, without guaranteeing that taxpayers of every district where these projects exist are treated equitably and humanely. What do you mean by that? Break that down for me a little bit.
We need fairness. If you come into a neighborhood and you're building, how come the people in the 3rd District aren't getting first access or first dibs on their job? How come we're not able to afford?
If they're building the 3rd District, you're saying.
Yes, in mm-hmm. area of 3rd District. I mean, of course, all of Kansas City, again, that would be case by case. But in the area like 3rd District, we need fairness. You know, we need to be able to not only work in our communities, we need to be able to live in our communities. We need to be able to pass down houses and homes and generational wealth.
You know, but Melissa, is it time to say no to any more tax incentives for development in downtown Kansas City? Has the time come to turn off that spigot?
I think it's important for the city and the city council and mayor to define what the priorities are related to development. And so that comes with collaboration. You need 7 votes to get anything done. And so it's important for the city council to work together to say, these are our priorities. We're going to create a TIF district, if you will, or make sure that our priorities are being taken care of when we talk to developers, and so that we're not on the defensive of responding to projects that developers want to do, but developers are responding to projects that we feel are a priority for the city.
Given your vantage point as vying for the 3rd District City Council seat, are you frustrated with the ongoing incentives being given to downtown projects? Is it time to say no more on that end and to force more focus on the 3rd District?
We want to focus on the 3rd District. We know that the development of downtown is important because it is the front door to your city as it relates to that and the airport.
So you're not willing to say no to everything going forward.
You have to look at it case by case. We have to make sure that we're building a quality education system. We have to make sure that developers are responding to the priorities of the 3rd District, and we need strong advocacy when we look at those payments in lieu of taxes to ensure that the residents are feeling the investment, those community benefits agreements that happen as well. Everyone needs to feel the investment and the wealth, and we all need to rise together.
Joey, would you say no to any more downtown incentives?
Would I say no to any more downtown incentives? Not at the moment.
Okay.
Yes. Again, case by case.
Not at the moment, meaning you would say...
Not at the moment, meaning that I would love to have more time to have a more educated answer. Because, again, benefits should be something that everybody should be able to benefit from.
All right.
Period.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Melissa Robinson, Joey Thomas, the two candidates for Kansas City City Council, the 3rd in-district seat. Just residents in the 3rd will be voting on this race. Thank you both for sharing your views. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, should 16-year-olds be allowed to vote for president? We're going to kick it around here. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we hosted a live debate with Kansas City mayoral candidates Quentin Lucas and Jolie Justice. You can hear all of that debate at Union Station at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow on the show, how Brown versus Board of Education isn't talked about as much anymore and why it should be. The author of a book that tells the importance of modern integration. Join us tomorrow for that conversation on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, student activism in the wake of the February 2018 mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School down in Parkland, Florida, have some making another call to lower the voting age to 16. The argument, 16-year-olds are just as knowledgeable about civics and have the same ability to make good voting choices as older voters. Others question that. A change would require a constitutional amendment, but state legislatures are free to pass laws that would allow younger voters to vote in their state state elections. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi favors the idea, and Congress has considered it as well. Now a conversation about allowing 16-year-olds to vote for President of the United States. With us, Greg Vannami is an associate professor of political science at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Greg, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for the invitation.
Brian Connor is president of the National Youth Rights Association. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Brian, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Your questions to our listeners and comments on lowering the voting age to 16 or 17 are welcome. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Brian, let me start with you. I mean, there are a lot of people listening right now who almost surely are thinking, you've got to be kidding me. They're thinking, when I was 16, I didn't know what day of the week it was, much less knowing how to cast votes for the highest offices in the land and in state government. Address that, if you would. What would you say to that?
Right. So for one thing, voting is a fundamental human right. It's something that is essential for a democracy. So the idea that there's such thing as a right vote or that you have to know certain things to vote, I think, goes against what democracy should be. Okay. But also, 16 and 17-year-olds can drive and work and pay taxes, so they're already playing a large part in our democracy.
Professor Vannami, what do you make of this idea of allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to vote? What's your sense?
Well, to my knowledge, there's no precedent for it in American history that, at least at the state or the federal level, it's certainly nothing that the federal government has required. No states have allowed that in statewide or federal elections as well. There are some local governments that have allowed 16-year-olds to vote in local school board elections. Mm-hmm. Cross-nationally, there are a few examples. Austria allowed 16-year-olds to vote and have since 2009, Argentina in 2011. So there's some record for that. The experience of it is mixed. In terms of the likelihood of it in the U.S., I think it's a fairly remote possibility that we'll see this nationwide. And I'd be skeptical that many states would adopt this for state or federal elections.
I was going to say, Brian, is there a groundswell of interest in this idea across the country? What are you seeing?
Definitely. We've been advocating for lowering the voting age for 20 years, and then in the last maybe 6 years, it's finally started to really catch on. So four towns in Maryland have lowered their voting ages for local elections, and there have been federal bills introduced and campaigns in lots of states and local governments to lower the voting ages, including in Missouri and Iowa, and this year there's a bill being introduced in Nebraska.
And you got a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives this year, if I understand right.
Yes. So we had 125 Democrats and one Republican voting in favor of lowering the voting age for federal elections. And that would have been just for federal elections. But there's also a bill in the House now that would amend the Constitution to lower it for all elections.
And Brian, if I understand right, that vote was part of a larger package of initiatives under the umbrella of either voting rights or ethics or something like that, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. How many more people, Brian, would it enfranchise, and what are the estimates of how many more people would be voting if this change were to occur?
Yes, so in Tacoma Park, when they lowered their voting age in 2013, that's a town in Maryland, the 16 and 17-year-olds had 44% turnout compared to 11% total turnout. So we'd expect very high turnout from 16 and 17-year-olds.
That's initially. Do you think it would endure?
Yes, it has. They have continued to have that high turnout in Tacoma Park and the other towns in Maryland.
Hmm. Professor Vannami, polls suggest that Americans strongly oppose the idea. A Harris survey I showed that 75% of registered voters opposed allowing 17-year-olds to participate in elections. An even larger number, 84%, opposed allowing 16-year-olds to vote. That surprise you at all?
I guess the margins might surprise me.
Yeah,
that's a little high. To get 75-80% of Americans agree on anything these days, it's fairly rare. I'd also be a little bit surprised that there's not more of a partisan divide. Mm-hmm. This is an issue that Democrats tend to be more supportive of.
Explain that to me. Why is that?
So there's two aspects. So Brian is right. There's a perspective of voting as a right, and Democrats tend to emphasize that aspect of voting. There's also a sense of voting as a responsibility, that it's something that we should take seriously and be informed about, that it's not just something our right to do, but our responsibility as citizens. Republicans tend to adopt more of that perspective. So in that sense, it's reasonable for Democrats to generally favor a more expansive franchise. Mm-hmm. They want more people to show up, and they want more people to have the right to vote generally.
Is there also a feeling, Professor, that a lot of these young people who might vote would probably vote Democratic?
Yeah, so I pulled some numbers. So if you want to know how this would look, so if we expand this nationwide, that would enfranchise 2.6% more Americans.
Wow.
To be eligible to mm-hmm. vote. A lot of those wouldn't actually vote. So if you look at young voters now and you just interpolate that backwards, we'd get about a 1% increase in actual turnout.
Mm-hmm.
It could be more Democratic. Young voters are one of the most consistent Democratic voting blocks. In 2016, that would look like about a net gain of about a tenth of a percent for Hillary Clinton. It wouldn't have made a significant difference for the national popular vote. It wouldn't have changed the Electoral College. It wouldn't have changed any state Electoral
That's
College
interesting.
Vote.
Yeah. Brian, do you buy this idea that a lot of the new voters, if this were to happen, would probably skew Democratic?
I don't think so. So for one thing, that like 18 to 21-year-olds have had low turnout, but 16 and 17-year-olds have had very high turnout. So one part of that is that 16 is just a more stable time in your life. At 18, you're going off to college, you're moving away from your parents for whatever other reason, and it's not a time when people are going to start something new like voting. So in other countries and in the towns in the U.S., 16 and 17-year-olds have had much higher turnout than 18 to 21-year-olds. And also, I think the issue with the two parties right now is that Republicans just aren't speaking to young people as much. And they think that because our political views are formed when we're young. So if Republicans did speak to the issues that matter to young people, like Reagan did in 1984, and he won that generation of youth, and they still vote heavily Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So if Republicans speak to the issues that matter to young people and engage young people more, we'd see much less of a partisan divide.
You know, Professor, one argument that resonates with me a little bit here is that by changing the voting age and lowering it to 16, it would help develop a habit. If people started to vote at a younger age, they would get used to the idea of going to the polls, and it would become part of a life pattern, if you will. Do you buy that?
Yes. Evidence mm-hmm. consistently shows that voting and other forms of civic engagement are habit-forming. So the more we vote, and presumably the earlier we start voting, the more likely we'll continue as voters mm-hmm. later in life.
And that might not be a bad thing, given our participation rates going back so many years here.
our participation rates are not great, either historically or cross-nationally.
Yeah. And Brian, what do you say to that, this idea that this would start a lifetime habit of voting if we lower the age?
Yes, that's definitely true. And like I said before, 16 and 17-year-olds are more likely to start voting than 18 and 19-year-olds. So giving them the right to vote just means that we'll see much higher voter turnout in general. It was four times the total turnout in Tacoma Park.
Yeah. Should 16-year-olds be allowed to vote for president? That's the question on the table here. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Now, states, Professor, can make individual decisions that allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in state elections. If I heard you right, no states have done that yet, and we have any sense of their experience or even experiences of other countries?
So at the states, no, none that I'm aware of. And when a state passed a law, so if a state passed a law allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in state elections, that would also inherit to federal elections. So they would also be able to participate in congressional, senatorial, and presidential
inside
elections.
Inside that state?
Inside that state.
Oh, that's
right.
Interesting.
So the evidence cross-nationally is pretty mixed. Turnout among 16 and 17-year-olds nationwide in those countries looks similar to other young people. So they're no more likely to vote than other young people. They've looked at whether it increases interest, if it increases knowledge. So if you have the right to vote, maybe you're more interested, you pay more attention, you become more educated.
Do you?
No.
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 Really?
It doesn't make it worse. You're not less likely to pay attention. But the balance of the evidence is that no, in general, it doesn't increase knowledge. So there is a study from Sweden, for example, that looked at young people that that were eligible to vote within a month of the election, to young Swedish people that were a month outside of the barrier. So they were virtually identical populations, except one just barely had the right to vote, the other didn't. There was no difference at all in their levels of political knowledge.
And they did a survey and checked people, and they figured all that stuff out,
yeah.
Eh?
Yeah.
Okay. Young people voting for the presidency, that's our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Frank from Liberty. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Steve. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one quick question, and I don't necessarily oppose a 16-year-old vote, but I would suggest to the panel a question that would it be worthwhile, I understand that voting is a right, but would it be worthwhile for a 16-year-old to pass a simple civics test prior to getting the right to vote, which is an oxymoron, you have the right or you don't. But the question is, would that help for them to offer an opinion by way of voting and understanding what it is they're voting for by understanding the methods of government? That might even apply to some adults.
Brian Conner, how about a civics test before you can vote? What do you think of that idea?
Well, I think we established back with the Civil Rights Act in 1963 that establishing a test to see if people are eligible to vote is wrong and undemocratic. Yes,
but
so the idea
time,
that people...
Is it not wrong to pass an opinion on something that you don't understand or don't know anything about?
Well, that's a question we should be asking to all voters then.
Well, this is interesting.
Absolutely.
Frank, let me chime in here for a minute, because there was a study in the Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science, and it found that on measures of civic knowledge, political skills, political efficacy, and tolerance, that 16-year-olds on average are obtaining scores similar to those of adults. If that's a good survey, and I didn't look yet, I just read about it, I guess I don't have a whole lot to argue with there, Frank.
No, that's a good point, but... If that's the truth, then it's fantastic. But as I said, you know, this simple test might be something good to pass to adults as well.
Yeah.
Civics is not something that's taught very well in school anymore.
Right.
It's sort of been pushed aside.
Professor Vanami, what do you make of this idea of a civics test before somebody could vote?
So a couple of observations.
A lot of adults would probably fail.
That was one of the points that I was going to make.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that the study showed that 16-year-olds are scoring similarly to the adults probably doesn't speak to how well the 16-year-olds did, but how poorly a lot of us do.
Right.
We would have to amend the Voting Rights Act, so federal law prohibits literacy tests or competency tests. So that would something that would have to be changed. Sorry, I'm drawing a blank on the third point that I was going to make. I'm having my Rick Perry moment here.
I live in that world here. Brian, anything else you would add to that idea?
We know that a lot of adults don't know who their representatives are. There have been some like really wild studies about that. Like,
right.
Lots of adults don't know the Earth revolves around the sun and all sorts of stuff like that. So,
Robert from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Stephen. So I just wanted to pose a comment and listen to the response off the air. But if you speak with people of this age, 16 and 17, they refer to each other as they still refer to each other as kids, not adults. If you speak to people of the age of 18, they call themselves kids, their generation kids. There are 22-year-olds, 24-year-olds that they just refer to themselves as kids, not adults is what they define themselves as.
And so
adults,
your point is
kids.
What, Robert?
So should we be, so if they self-identify as kids, then should we really be opening up voting to self-identify children.
If you call yourself a kid, does that make a difference, Professor?
In some ways, this does cut across the cultural narrative. So the cultural narrative today is about prolonged adolescence and delayed independence. So in a way, lowering the voting age would I think that's maybe the caller's point. The other point that I was going to make is that interpolating young voter patterns of young voters backwards to 16 and 17-year-olds might not be accurate, because one thing we do know from studies of socialization is that parental socialization is most important for children's formative experiences up until the age of 18. Wow. So they might not be as democratic as those 18 to 21-year-olds are, because they'll be more influenced by their parents. They'll be more likely to reflect parents' participation and their partisanship.
But bottom line here, Professor, you don't think this change is going to happen anytime soon?
I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. If it did, I think some of the optimism from the Democrats and some of the pessimism from the Republicans, I think it would probably land with more of a whimper than a bang, even if it happened.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Professor Greg Vannami from the UMKC Political Science Department. We were also joined by Brian Connor, president of the National Youth Rights Association. Brian, thanks so much for your time.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and some fun stuff to do on your weekend.
She walks through the field, walks in the heat through the field. She swings with her arm, but can what she catches be real? And when you look into her eyes, you see what you want. When everything was undone, everything was open, nothing was impossible yet. The kid with the butterfly net. The kid with the butterfly net.
Well, look who's here. Brian McTavish should do some... offer up some good recommendations on things to do this weekend. How are you? Welcome back. Always nice to see you.
I am fine. I welcome myself back as well with equal enthusiasm, and it is also great to see you, Mr. Steve.
And it's a big weekend in Kansas City.
Oh, boy, it's a
big slick weekend.
That's right. Yeah. 10th annual Big Slick. Now, I'm playing this song, The Kid with the Butterfly Net by Graham Parker, because it is one of the most precious, wonderful songs about childhood and the dreams that childhood provides.
And that's what Big Slick's really sort
it's
of all about.
It's all about the kids. It's that great fundraiser for Children's Mercy Hospital. There's a Big Slick softball game, a bowling tournament, a party, and a show. We'll get to the details briefly, all benefiting Children's Mercy, Friday and Saturday at a variety of locations. Who's back? Well, let me tell you.
They're all back.
Isn't that great? These Hollywood funny guys. Rob Riggle, Paul Rudd, Jason Sudeikis, all graduates of Shawnee Mission School District. So there's the hometown connection.
There you go.
They also have David Koechner coming back and Eric Stone Street and many, many other familiar faces. Would you like to talk about some of those?
Yes.
Sure, let's do it. Let's at least list a few. How about Selena Gomez, the hit singer?
Yeah.
She's part of the plan.
That's amazing.
Well, let's have KC Chiefs quarterback and reason to exist these days, Pat Mahomes. Okay.
Right.
How about Saturday Night Live and Kansas City native Heidi Gardner? How about CNN anchor Jake Tapper?
Yeah, right.
How about Sudeikis' wife, Olivia Wilde, who is the critic's darling director of the high school coming-of-age film called Booksmart. Everybody loves it, except the people that don't go. I guess it's a bit of a dud. We'll have to clap for Olivia. Anyway, very briefly, there's the celebrity softball game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, show up early, Friday night for the Royals game. The famous people will play and make you laugh. Then Saturday morning and afternoon, there's the celebrity bowling tournament and block party. Great red carpet opportunity there out at Prairie Fire Shopping Mall in Leawood. And the big event, it's moving to Sprint Center. The big, big slick party and show. They're moving it to Sprint. So
that's
check
amazing.
It out.
That's amazing. That's a
sign. Saturday
it's
night.
Big.
More music, more comedy, more Children's Mercy. Good stuff.
If you brought a big brown bag of them home, I'd jump up and down and hope you'd toss me a carrot. I'm gonna keep well my vegetables.
I like vegetables. I'm a big vegetable fan.
Well, you know, they say
I got a good record on vegetables.
Really?
Yes, I do.
Well, keep talking.
I cut up a bunch of fresh ones every day for lunch.
What kind?
I do broccoli and carrots and a little radish and, got some olives in there and whatever I do.
I'm a canned corn fan. I can't help it. I love
you,
Mom.
Is that right?
Mom,
canned
I,
corn.
Mom, I love you.
What's wrong with corn on the cob?
I love you with all my heart, but you raised me on canned vegetables.
Well, we're talking about vegetables because...
Veg Fest. Vegetables are good for you.
I didn't know we had a veg fest
we
in
do,
town.
We do, we do. 6 to 10 Friday in the evening, 10 to 6 all day Saturday, 10 to 4 Sunday at City Market Park. It is said by the organizers that a plant-rich lifestyle is better for people, the environment, and let's face it, the otherwise edible animals that
this
fall.
Is down at City Market?
City Market Park, right.
It's that
Friday
good.
Night,
I
Saturday,
like,
and Sunday.
I like vegetables.
So
I might go there.
Expert,
go there.
You should go. You should go and tell them about how you cut them up and eat them with such excitement. Okay, so there are presenters on the subject of vegetables. There's cooking demos. There's kids' activities. There's even beer. Is that a vegetable?
Wow, we'll find out.
Okay, anyway, yeah. Special evening event Saturday at City Market Park. Ain't nothing but a V thing. It's the Vegan Mix and Mingle Party. You can meet new vegans.
Okay.
So do it. I suggest it strongly.
Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with the fringe on top. Watch that fringe.
Oklahoma.
Gosh, I wish somebody would take me for a ride in the Surrey with the fringe on top.
Yes.
Just putting that out there.
I never really understood what that was, but...
It's a thing that horses, you tie to the horses. It's a carriage.
Oh,
and it's
okay.
Got the little fringe on top.
Oh, I see.
Anyway,
okay.
If you're not sure, perfect for you, go see Oklahoma. This is from the fantastic musical, the legendary American stage musical by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein that... it was their first collaboration in the 1940s, and it was a trendsetter on Broadway with all the songs actually furthering the plot and the character development. They didn't just stop the action and sing and dance. So, a couple of things here. Oklahoma, 7 tonight. You can see it Friday night, Saturday, Sunday at MTH Theater at Crown Center. That's a musical theater, Heritage Theater at Crown Center.
Right.
Also, a shout-out to The Wizard of Oz, which opens Monday at Starlight Theater.
Oh,
go have
right?
your childhood memory. Everybody has a Wizard of Oz childhood memory. Go get one starting Monday, Wizard of Oz Starlight Theater.
Okay, let's listen to our little Roger Daltrey.
Oh, yeah. Walk in the dog. Just walk.
Why is Roger singing about walking the dog?
Well, it was 1975. He was on top of the world. Let's cut a solo album.
Yes.
This was one of the tracks. I appreciated it. It's somewhere deep in the bin at home for me. Anyway, it's the 32nd annual Dog and Jog.
Mm.
You can 32nd annual. Wow.
Wow.
So you can hoof it with your doggy in a 2-mile run or a 1-mile run, or here's my style, a 1-mile walk. I just got to get me a dog to do it. Just got to get me a pooch. 7 to 10:30 in the morning. That's the AM, all you Saturday night fun seekers. So get up bright and early Sunday. Go down to the Country Club Plaza and don't miss the wiener dog race, 9:30 in the morning, okay? And if you do the wiener dog race and bring your wiener dog, make sure you bring a second person to catch the dog at the finish line, because otherwise the plaza will be overrun with dachshunds.
With wiener dogs.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm telling you what. Have fun.
And finally today.
Finally.
And what do we have here?
I'll bet you've never heard that song
I
before.
I have not heard that
it's
song.
Called,
it's kind of a dreary song
called,
about Harry Potter.
Well, you know, it's sort of an alt-rock thing. It's called I Am a Wizard by Harry and the Potters. I couldn't resist. So, it's Harry Potter Day at the K coming up Saturday, right?
Right.
Gates open early at 11:30 for all you Harry Potter fans. And let's face it, at Kauffman Stadium, or on the road or at home, our Royals need a little bit of magic.
Yes, they do.
Right, or how about a lot of magic?
Yes,
so,
they do.
So, you go, and if you spend a little extra, if you'd like to, there's a special theme ticket to a VIP area. You get a photo op with live owls. Right? As opposed to owls, which are no longer breathing, I guess.
That wouldn't
be
good.
No, that'd be bad. You get Harry Potter glasses, maybe a wizard photo booth op, and everyone who stays after the game, which hopefully will be a Royals victory, gets to watch Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the first Harry Potter film on the big Oh, big really? Scoreboard, the crown.
Not
vision.
A lot of wins lately.
Well,
thank you, sir. That's right. Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to the author who believes that society has given up on integrating modern communities. Join us for that conversation. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.